From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the third segment in a series of discussions about the art of literary translation. For example, what is the status of translation into English of Latin American and African literatures? What are some of the aesthetic and social responsibilities of translators as cultural mediators? Addressing those and other questions, the panelists are Richard Bjornson, Suzanne Jill Levine, Serge Gavronsky, and André Lefebvre. Richard Bjornson recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a book about literature and national identity in Cameroon. Suzanne Jill Levine teaches at Tufts University. Serge Gavronsky is a professor at Barnard College. André Lefebvre teaches at the University of Georgia. Here is Richard Bjornson.
I think perhaps one of the first questions that the man in the street would ask about translation might be, why translate? I think there are two aspects involved here. First of all, a good number of books have already been translated, and people might ask, why translate them again? Don Quixote has been translated a number of times, so has Faust. But I think there's an even more deep-lying question, and that is, why translate at all? We have authors who have expressed themselves in Dutch or German or Hindi or Japanese, and these are directed toward a particular audience. Why should we as Americans be concerned with the act of translation?
Well, after Babel, we have no choice but to translate, because we're all speaking many different languages. And I think that, you know, obviously, as you say, all the great masterpieces of literature, I mean, we wouldn't be able to read them if it wasn't for translation, beginning with the Bible. No, so I mean, that's obviously one major response. I mean, that we really have no choice but to interpret.
I think another reason is a curious one. We somehow assume that literature is not a national holding. We somehow assume that the novels or great poems, like painting or music, crosses national barriers. And so, in an interesting way, we don't really consider them as foreign. They may be, by the time they get into our language, have the marks of their ethnicity or their cultural context, but initially, we would like to consider the world's literature as ours, and great literature, in quotes, as it was done, for example, in Chicago, never restricted itself to that which was written in English. I think that's a very charming way of fraternally considering literature.
Linking up with that, from the point of view of minority literatures, there's also the very obvious fact that if you don't exist in a majority language, you do not exist at all on a world scale, so,
yeah.
Which is, in a way, it's a bit different because you don't cater to the needs of the majority culture.
Well, I think also an answer to the question of the whole topic of minority cultures and bringing them into the mainstream. I mean, we have a very good, very recent example of Latin American literature. Because 40 years ago, when Borges was writing his best works, which is really his best era in the 30s and 40s, nobody knew in this country, anyway, about what was going on in Latin American literature. They assumed that was the land of the gauchos and the bandidos mexicanos, and that, if anything, what kind of literature was being written there was a very regionalistic, a very limited type of literature that only had anthropological value. As a matter of fact, I think Lionel Trilling once summed up Latin American literature as purely having anthropological value. And I think that what we've seen now, obviously the most recent Nobel Prize is an example of that, and to Garcia Marquez and all the recent articles about the intellectual in Latin America that are being printed in Time, you know, the New York Times, that you could see that this is merely the journalistic response, but in any case, you could see that all the translating that has gone on the last decade or so of Latin American literature has really brought it into the mainstream. And now we're realizing the interrelationship between North American and Latin American literature. For example, in many universities, professors are giving courses on the relationship between the works of Donald Barthelme and Thomas Pynchon and Borges, it's a whole world of literature that has been opened up, and a whole world of interrelationship that, in a sense, if without the translator, it wouldn't have been available to us.
The other thing, which goes back to, in a sense, the minority issue, is the responsibility of a translator, apart from the desire to communicate that text which he loves, for example, it may also be a moral decision on his part. You were speaking about South America. Well, so far, Arabic texts have not been widely disseminated in this country. And it may very well be that one day we'll discover that there lies a fantastically rich source, in a sense, richer than the South American one. So the reason it has not passed into our language yet is perhaps a political one, not even to speak about an ideological situation. And I think the translator cannot be totally oblivious to those processes operating within the culture and within his own mind.
In other words, we sort of learn something about ourselves by reading people from another culture. I think it was Matthew Arnold who once said, you'll never know your own culture unless you know at least one other culture as well. And this reminds me of the story of García Márquez, whom you mentioned just a moment ago. García Márquez was perhaps impelled into writing a certain kind of literature by his experience with William Faulkner. He said, when I read Faulkner, I discovered that his South was very similar to the Colombia in which I grew up. Now, that he would be retranslated back into English and would have something very poignant to say to American audiences might be perfectly natural, because he might be saying something about an area which has similar sociological, political situations as those that exist in the United States. When they're retranslated into English, they say something from a slightly different perspective that shows us something about our own situation. And this then could become the source of future creativity within our own culture. I can think of examples before. We were talking about enriching the culture. The fact that Oedipus or Don Quixote or Faust are available to English-speaking people, despite the fact that they might not know Greek or Spanish or German, means that other things are possible for someone who begins thinking in our own culture, whether they're a creative writer or not.
Something else in that connection would also be that what Dick was saying and what Jill was saying, so this idea of having a common language that you translate from cultures that have established something, a framework which is similar to that which you are in. I would try to move that a bit farther and say it's a common poetics as well. So it's something you translate much more easily from a culture which has the same conventions, the same literary conventions. You have sonnets in most European literatures, and then you translate sonnets. Your audience will remember or will know, will recognize this as a sonnet. Sonnet went into Chinese only about 1912. I mean, so it's a different thing. And that might explain also not just what Serge was saying too, not just the political obstacles, but that might also explain why so few Arabic texts have been translated and have been integrated into anything English speaking, because the whole poetics framework is quite different. There are genres and text types which we are not familiar with.
Well, there are two things that I have noticed in trying to translate Francophone African literature, and that is that I'm dealing with two cultures, because any African who writes in French is necessarily the inheritor of an entire French tradition of literature, as well as an indigenous, largely oral tradition. So that the French that he will be writing will be quite different from a French being written in Europe. In any Francophone country. I can think of a certain number of examples that show me that even metaphors that are chosen would be inexplicable to an average Frenchman.
For instance?
For example, I can recall having translated a short story by a Cameroonian writer, René Filon. The story described a house that was set in the forest, and it described the house as if there were a cat gradually wrapping its tail around the roof of the house. The metaphor made no sense to me at all, until I recalled having been in an African village where everyone cooks their food inside the house. There is a small gap between the roof of the house and the walls of the house. The smoke from the fire escaping from the from what is being cooked comes out underneath the roof, gradually wraps itself around the house, and almost looks as if it is a hat covering the house. Now, had I not seen this, the image would have made no sense to me at all. And this brings me to another aspect of translation, perhaps, and that is the necessity to have some feeling for not only the linguistic context, but the cultural context out of which poems come. The same writer that I mentioned a moment ago, when I interviewed him, told me, my native language is Eton. In Eton, which is a tonal language, in other words, any syllable can be on one of three tone levels. This allows for certain poetic possibilities which are impossible to emulate in a European language. René told me, I have hundreds of poems in Eton reverberating through my head. I shall never be able to write them.
Well, this is more like music than language as we know it.
Oh, it is not. It's certainly the equivalent of language as we know it. Mm-hmm. But the difficulty is that he lives in an area where perhaps 50,000 people speak his language. If he were to write in that language, which can be transliterated, of course, and was transliterated largely by Bible translators, and that presents an interesting problem that we might want to come back to later, because those translators were working from English translations of the Bible in order to produce translations in Eton or Bassa or Bulu or other African languages, he could do it. And there would be perhaps 4,000 or 5,000 people who would be able to read what he had written. Now, whether or not these people actually would read it is another question. But when you think of the potential audience that he has in French, perhaps 150 to 300 million people who are capable of reading what he has written, he obviously is going to write in French rather than writing in Eton. This leads him to want to emulate certain patterns that exist in Eton that skew his poetry in ways that a French poet's poetry would never be skewed. So having access to this kind of information is very important in making the kind of choices that the translator is continually confronted with.
I'd like to go back to what Dick mentioned about the Francophone work that he's been dealing with. I have had a little practice with the Antilles, with the Francophone poetry in the Antilles, with Aimé Césaire. The questions that are raised are multiple. One of them, for example, is the status of oral literature. Generally speaking, as far as we're concerned, it's sort of considered as popular and, as a consequence, not literary. That's one of our cants, in a sense. The Griot's production, by the time it's transferred into French, is considered as folk material, which it is not in their own context necessarily. The second one is when a Francophone writer decides to write in French, which is a decision he can make, he can do that or another one, his writings become very complicated because on the one hand, he requires of his reader a familiarity with the French texts and others that he has assimilated, and you will see signs of it in his work. And on the other hand, that sort of dark aspect, which we ignore, coming from the oral tradition, from his own language. And how this thing comes together is very interesting. Aimé Césaire says, I have tried to blacken French. It's a very desperate effort to write in French as an African, that is to introduce tones, as he was speaking, to do certain things to the French poetic line that an African would immediately hear as not coming from Lamartine, not coming from L'Outre-Amont, that is neither from the Romantic stock nor from, if you want, a very avant-garde. But this is, again, a very complicated decision because I don't hear it. I only look at the French language and I can trace out its metrical patterns, and I say to myself, this is French. As a matter of fact, it happens to be marvelous French. And he will say, no, you are mistaken. Underneath, you should hear the tom-tom. And I said, I'm sorry, I can just count the syllables.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. Conversations with Scholars and Visitors at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to the third segment in a series of conversations about the art of literary translation. The panelists are Andre Lefevre of the University of Georgia, Richard Bjornson of Ohio State University, Suzanne Jill Levine of Tufts University, and Serge Gavronsky of Barnard College. Here is Richard Bjornson.
Now, this sort of situation, I think, poses a distinct problem for the translator, because an European or an American audience is capable of understanding an African novel in terms of novelistic technique, how plots are put together, how characters are characterized, and yet they will not recognize the beat of the tom-tom behind it. Whereas an African audience capable of understanding the beat of the tom-tom is not generally acclimatized to reading novels at all. And so the African writer is in a considerable dilemma, which the translator, in part, helps him out of by making him accessible to one of the two audiences to whom he's necessarily speaking.
Can I just go back to one thing? But one thing that you're saying that strikes me, that in some ways the African writer is a translator as well.
Absolutely.
He's translating his culture into French.
He mediates and he translates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And this really breaks down a myth that I think that we're playing around with, is that every language is one language. I mean, every language, be it the African, the Francophone that you're speaking of, or the Spanish of Latin America, or the English of the United States, is not one language. It's many languages. And therefore, perhaps that's something that, in reality, that our culture has, for example, in common with the French African culture, that there is a heterogeneity, there is a dialogue of, let's say, a dominant culture and a subculture, but nonetheless, there is a dialogue there. And in a sense, all novels, for example, are dialogues, too. They are dialogues of languages. I mean, beginning with Don Quixote. That's the dialogue of the chivalrous novel and the picaresque novel and the pastoral novel. I mean, all these forms are dialoguing, and there's not one language, there's many languages. So in a sense, this heterogeneity, this again, carnival of language, is what the translator is dealing with, but what the writer is dealing with as well, you see. It's not only the translator's problem.
Yeah. It gets even more complicated on, again, an institutional level. If you take the case of Nigeria, for instance, where there are about 52 indigenous languages, as we call them. They simply call them languages, but where you get also the problem of these African states, which have been created on a map in Berlin at the end of the 19th century, are now facing the problem of concocting some kind of national cultural heritage. And then the paradox from our point of view would be that they are now translating cultural offerings, products from these different languages back into English, so that you get the cultural heritage of an African nation is in English. And I would say, again, institutionally, where Césaire tries to blacken French, I think it still is to a great extent the case that the patronage group, so the people who determine what culture is, the people who publish, whiten English and French African writing still to this day, because it's published, if it has any kind of international audience, it will be published in London, in New York, in Paris. It also links up with what we said before, and maybe the way into that is the footnote, so what we were talking about. And I think the footnote links up with the cultural milieu, so the footnote you always get, and I think not just in translations. I mean, you get many footnotes in many African novels, for instance, where the African writer writes with one eye to the native audience, to the African audience, writes with another eye to the European audience, and you get a little explanatory paragraph. So you get the story, and then it's interrupted, and then there is a little anthropological essay that comes in. It's not just the Africans who do this, but it's also, I think maybe the best example of that in English literature would be D.H. Lawrence, The Plumed Serpent, where you get a story, and then you get chapter one, the story starts. Chapter two is an essay on a certain aspect of Mexican culture. Chapter three is a story. Chapter four is, again, a little essay, and so on. So
Moby Dick is another very good example of precisely the same thing.
Yeah. The Plumed Serpent isn't one of D.H. Lawrence's best novels.
No, but it's there. I would just say that it's perfectly permissible to start from the intention of the author and see how the author uses language to achieve that intention, and then to try to do the same thing with the resources of a totally different language and in a different culture, and that there is no reason to apologize for this.
That's right. It's not only admissible, it's necessary. And that's really what you're saying, it's indispensable. The writer is also limited by what his manner of expression, but it's also the language that he has. I mean, it's not yours that you own it. It's simply the language that, again, that we were saying, speaks that you that speaks through you, really, rather than the other way around. And I think that's where we want to come back to.
Well, I think there are two things that I'd like to bring into that. One, I think the more you translate, the more you perfect your own language, which is one of the reasons I like to translate. Not excessively, but it's a very enriching experience. It confronts you with all sorts of problems that thereafter, hopefully resolved, enriches your own ability to talk, write. In my own case, I write poetry, and I find that there are all sorts of echoes. They may be rhythmical or they may be lexical, but they enter into my own work. So I translate poetry. And the question there, of course, is always very clear. Will the text have the French on the left-hand side? If the text is on the left-hand side, then there are all sorts of questions that the translator can consciously ask. For example, you assume that a lot of people who will be reading this, let's say, anthology or even a single poet's work, know something about French. Consequently, what's the purpose of the translation? Is it to fill in the semantical gaps? Am I operating there as a sort of micro-dictionary so that they'll be looking on the left, they'll be enjoying the French, and when they're not sure, side vision, they'll take a peek at mine and they'll say, oh, that's what it means. Is that really what I want? Well, of course not. That's not at all what I want. What I feel is I want to give them as fine a poem in the English language as possible, which works interestingly as far as the French is concerned. Most people assume that French and English are very close. They're not. From my point of view, in poetry, for example, the French syntax is extremely tricky if you're going to work it into the English per se. That is, if you are going to follow its direction. Very frequently, when it gets into the English, it's so, in quotes, artificial. The French have a rhetorical tradition which goes totally above the heads of the French readers. That is their culture. They are not perturbed by that. In English, it's very disturbing. This is a question that I would like to ask to members around the table. I mentioned the word syntax, but the general question of tone, which is affected, of course, the rhythm, the length of the phrase. To what extent, not a question of substitution, to what extent does the translator impose a certain, not mediation, but in a sense transformation, so that the text is truly no longer French, but American?
A translation is not meant to supplant a text, but in a sense to coexist with it, like a mirror image. It's supposed to really have more, again, a dialogic relationship to it.
Could you say it's an interpretation, one interpretation of the text?
Well, this is where, of course, translation comes close to criticism, in that it is, in a sense, a comment, a commentary on the original. In this case, it's really like a mirror image, no? But it's not meant, so therefore, whether or not it is next to the text, it is there. It is there next to the original and translation are side by side. No, that was one general thing I wanted to say.
Only for the bilingual reader. Mm-hmm.
Yes, but in other words, even in the actual creation of the translation, it is there. I mean, because it's not meant to supplant it. It can't. It's never going to supplant it. It's just there as a commentary. If there was one thing you were talking about syntax, Well, obviously, there are great syntactical differences between English and Spanish. The fact that in Spanish, comma splicing, which we call in English, is very normal. I mean, you know, you can have a sentence that is a series of subordinate phrases, one comma after another, and that's perfectly legitimate. Whereas in English, we that's considered illegitimate, except of course when you're doing an interior monologue, for example, and you can have a sentence that runs on and on, because that's really more you're really taking stylistic license with English grammar. But certainly that is a great problem in translating these Baroque texts with their long sentences in Spanish, and how do you deal with that in English? Another problem that I was thinking of again has to do with the matter of alliteration. We have a great deal of prejudice against alliteration in English. And for example, there recently was a book about the translation of Neruda. John Felsen wrote a book called The Way to Machu Picchu, which is a very interesting book in the sense that it's interesting because it's about the making of a translation. And it's interesting that there exist books that are solely about that. But what he says there is that he had to at one point use an inexcusable alliteration. Something about stone stamens, you know, in a sense he wanted to give, but he called it inexcusable. And what's that was what struck me, because in a sense Spanish is of course a very musical language. I mean, you just hear it on the streets and you realize its musical quality. And what the English translator should try to do is to take advantage of whatever musical qualities there are, and there are many, of course, in English, to, again, approximate the spirit of the original language. And there you might be crossing some prejudice boundaries as to what is proper taste and what is improper taste. Then there's another thing, too, that is involved here, and that's the author's own vision of, if the author knows English, his own vision of his text in English. And this, for example, is the case of Borges or the case of Cabrera Infante. I know, for example, that Borges's style changed dramatically from the 30s to the 70s. And so when he translated or collaborated with his translator on stories that he wrote in the early 30s, he said, well, I will not have them translated unless they're totally rewritten. I want them to be written in a much plainer language so that the reader can understand them. And so for example, in one book of his, The Universal History of Infamy, we've completely lost a lot of his original and very bizarre metaphors, and they've been translated into cliches simply because Borges wanted it to be accessible to the reader and because he himself disagrees with his earlier writing. He wants it to be in plainer language.
In a curious way, it is because the South American writers have been now so well translated and diffused that both American publishers and perhaps an American audience is more likely to appreciate surrealism. There were times when I, in my own writing, would submit things and I would receive answers saying, this is too European. But now it no longer can be used as an example. They can say, now you see, all of South America writes this way. So they've opened up for American writers an area which up to a point had been taboo.
Yes, well, there's no doubt about it that the greatest writing going on in Latin America really is a rebirth of the whole avant-garde and surrealist era of literature.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to the third segment in a series of discussions about the art of literary translation. The panelists were Suzanne Jill Levine of Tufts University, Serge Gavronsky of Barnard College, Andre Lefebvre of the University of Georgia, and Richard Bjornson of Ohio State University. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.